Gotta get in the spirit.
Who's that, Doug? I just logged on.
It's Doug and Jim.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Well,
all I heard was the laughing. You gotta back me up and tell me what the joke was. I don't want to miss anything here.
Jim's wife is home.
Okay, what's the punchline?
I don't know if there's a punchline.
No, you were laughing.
From Iraq.
Oh, from Iraq.
I was just saying that, yeah, we're celebrating our 5-year anniversary, but she's been gone so much, it's more like 2.5 years.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that she was there.
Yeah, that's her second deployment.
So she's back for how long now?
2 weeks.
Wow. And then she goes back for how much longer?
Until July.
Until July. Wow. All right, hang tough, I guess. Yeah, it's a long, well, actually, it's March. Tomorrow's March.
Yeah.
And then she's back for good?
Theoretically.
Oh, good. Okay. Right, actually, Jim, I was looking over your question from last week, and it seems to be there's a lot to go on. So, you know, regarding the question of, you understand that people at Mount Sinai are the first generation, that they have the, they took it upon themselves to keep the Torah, but what about future generations who aren't there? Why are they obligated, right?
Right.
But the answer is going to be one of a few answers. Either it's going to be that it is not a Jewish or Gentile issue. And even if it is a Jewish issue, so is it that the people there accepted it on behalf of all future generations? Or they didn't, and then that means the third possibility, that everybody has to choose it for themselves. And then we'll just have to see if the sources work out that way in the Torah. So the way I'm looking at it, there's three possibilities. It's not a Jewish or Gentile issue. It's the fact, for example, at the Talmud Sanhedrin, it says that there's a dispute in the Gemara and the Talmud, but all the rabbis agree that there was at least one command that Adam had. So what does it tell you? Some say two, some say three. And then Noah had seven. But the fact that Adam had at least one command, which was the prohibition of idolatry, so what does that tell you?
There's already some obligating of further generations.
Yeah, meaning to say that man, as a species, is obligated. That even the first man had an obligation, that there was a... Because if there was no command at all, so then Adam would come on the world stage, and there would be no way to determine just from the world that there's an obligation in terms of serving the Creator. So the only way to have that is if there is an expression of the Creator requiring some form of observance to His word. And all you need for that is just one example. Once you have that expression, now you know that relationship, you know, that relationship exists. So if that's true, so that means the species as a whole has an obligation. And why would they have the obligation? Why would species have an obligation to serve the Creator?
It's sort of an inborn obligation. They were created with such a purpose.
Right. There'd be the fact that they are. Well, I would say like this, that they are created, the fact that they are created, that the human species and everything is created, that means it owes its existence. But there's an owing, there's a debt at the very fact that something created something else, that God created something else and he gave us needs and so on. So there's now a debt to the great benefit that you have as a creature that has such potential. Does it make sense?
It does.
Right, and when you talk about, you know, inborn, but also there's also the concept that the created, meaning mankind, recognizes that, you know, an intelligent person recognizes that there's nothing that that creation can do to benefit the creator. So when we talk about serving God, like Rabbi Chaitwin said, really it's serving yourself. I mean, if you act in accordance with intelligence and you do something which is best for you, and that is to have the constant awareness of a creator, so that's really for your own benefit. There's nothing God gets out of it. We can't ask why God did things. That's an implying motive to God. And motive is a human quality. So, well, like Maimonides says, all we can say is that it's his will that mankind should exist. And you see, it's not only mankind, but when we say in our prayers in the morning, we also praise God in terms of the fact that he created other intelligences. You know, the angels, the non-physical intelligences. So they too, there's another whole species that has the ability to recognize God. So God created, as far as we know, two different species that have the ability to recognize God and to be enamored by it and to derive great joy from it. An overwhelming enjoyment from the reality. And yeah, that's what we really call, you know, Ahavas Hashem, love of God. When we see that and we are thirsting to see more, we're interested, you know, like an Einstein, you know, locking himself away for weeks on end in a laboratory to figure out something just because it captivates the mind. It's of great interest to see how the world works and to see the reflection of the Creator in it. So when we see that, we have such a sense of appreciation for the wisdom and appreciation for the fact that we were created. So I mean, again, I still have to go further with this, but I'm just, you know, sharing with you just some of my thoughts on it as I was going through it this week. I was going through a lot of sources. It's an important question. I'm glad you asked it again. So I'm going to continue. Maybe we'll have something more conclusive next week. I'm not making a purposeful cliffhanger. I just haven't gotten, I'm not satisfied that I've really, you know, exhausted the sources yet, myself, and flowed into them. It's just a lot more than I anticipated.
Does anything about the mission of Israel make it imperative upon further generations? I mean, that creates the obligation itself?
I mean, think of that too. That's an interesting thing that you're mentioning that, because that's one of the cases where it says the Torah was given with three treaties. One treaty was on Mount Sinai. I think one was 40 years later when they're about to enter the land, and there's another one. The question is, what does that mean? The Torah was given with three treaties. I mean, there was an agreement made. So the Jews at Mount Sinai, they accepted the Torah after they heard, you know, main portions of it. And they said to Moses, everything that you have told us, we will do. And whatever we haven't, you know, heard from you yet, we'll listen. We'll do and we'll listen. A famous statement. Meaning to say that there are two perfections. And it says in the Talmud that the 600,000 men above 20 that were at Sinai, so when they said we will do and we will listen, so there were 600,000 ministering angels that came and attached two crowns to each one of them. But the idea is that they attached two crowns. And what were the two crowns? One crown means, it's a metaphor. There was no real physical crown. And actually the Torah itself says the term adornment. It doesn't use a literal word crown, but it says that after they sinned by the golden calf, so it says no man put his crown on him. But it doesn't mean crown. The actual word in the Torah is adornment. So you see the Torah avoided using the term to make it sound like a real literal crown. Where would you get a crown from? Just magic? They said to Moses that we'll do and we'll listen. So poof, I mean, these two crowns just appeared on the head. So it really means that there were two merits that they had. And a crown is something which sits on your head because you're trying to demonstrate the significance of the head, the mind, the intelligence. So the one merit was they said they will do, meaning when they heard the ideas, so they accepted them and they said, we'll do these ideas. And they accepted it on authority, but they also said, we'll listen, meaning we'll use our intelligence too. Listening means that we'll listen and we'll understand and come to appreciate new ideas. So that's why it's necessary in life that a person really recognizes the source of the Torah. So there's the fact that there's the authoritative character to it. It's the creator that's giving it to you. But that does not mean that you should be absent-minded. It means you should use intelligence too. So that's what the two merits were. That they had the trust in the creator, and they also were going to use, they were going to apply intelligence. So that's what it means, the two crowns. But you see, there was one acceptance, but then there was another acceptance in when they came into, they were about to enter the land. To your point now, Jim, about how they were first to become a people, so now is there a separate type of a character now that the Jews were becoming a nation and they're entering the land. And there was when they finally got the promises of the blessings and also the curses. Tremendous curses if they would break it. Meaning, it seems to be only once they accepted this new role as entering the land, being an isolated phenomena in the world as a people. So now this carried with it the fact that if they accept this, it appears fair too that it was only upon their acceptance of this that now they would have such such tragedies. It doesn't seem that you see on the individual basis prior to entering the land, you don't see that Esav, Jacob's brother, was wicked and he was involved in idolatry. So there was no tragedies. If you look in the Torah, there are lengthy tragedies that it talks about that God promises to the Jewish nation if they violate the Torah. And you see there was a Holocaust, something which is unmatched in all of history to the Jews. So you see there's a fulfillment of that. But the idea is that once they now entered the nation, the land of Israel as a nation of Jews, so now they became a new phenomenon. And now they were going to be a people, and God was going to be their God. It says that in the verses. What does that mean? It means, to your point, Jim, that they're going to be a unique phenomenon in the world. And they're going to be what God uses to demonstrate the great life you can have if you follow him, and the severe tragedy that you'll have if you don't follow him. And actually, if you look in those verses, in where it talks about the curses, I think it's not in Netzavim, in Bechukosai, at the end of Leviticus, so you see that the nations are going to say, but in Netzavim itself, that's Netzavim is in the Deuteronomy. So if you look in that section right from the beginning and you read through, you'll see that God's going to make such a tragedy and such devastation to the Jews that the other nations are going to say, what happened to this land that is so devastated? It must be because the Jews violated God's word. It's going to be such an unnatural type of a tragedy that the Jews will face if they violate the Torah. So it has to be that way to show that God's keeping his promise, to show that this is not just a nation like any other nation now. These are the people that now have an intimate relationship with God. And the way that is shown, it's displayed that they have tremendous greatness when they're following the Torah and tremendous tragedy if they don't follow it, to the point that the other nations will respond and they will attest to the fact that it must be because they forsook their God. But that's only once they entered the land of Israel. So it's a different type of a relationship now. But it's for the sake of the whole world, you see. Because God wants that response to be there by the other nations. He wants the Jew now to be the educator of the rest of the world. And they'll be educating whether they're living the good life or whether they're living the bad life. If they live an evil life, the devastation will be so unparalleled and so horrific that it will also equally teach the rest of the world that this is what happens when you violate God. Right? It's an important point. You see the verses bear that out. God purposely records in the Torah what the nations are going to say to teach you that that's really the objective, that the life of the Jew as a nation is now going to be something witnessed by the rest of the world so they too can come to the goodness. So when they see that there is this relationship that God has with mankind, they will want to attach themselves to and be part of this nation, and then in whatever you know capacity they follow. They're going to want to be educated by them, and they want to live the lifestyle that the Torah beats out, whether it's going to be the Noahide, whether it's going to be a Jewish lifestyle, whatever it is, but according to the Torah, whichever one a person picks. So it seems to be it's a different role altogether once they enter the land, because now it became a unique phenomenon. But there's a lot more. There's a lot on the verses, so I'll have to spend more time on that.
Thank you.
Sure. All right. So I said last week we do a little bit about the Megillah today, since today's Purim. So. I'll start and see if there's any questions that any of you had, if you looked it over at all. Okay, so I'll take that as no real questions yet. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, somebody there?
I'm sorry. I do have some questions, but I'm just trying to remember exactly where I found them. I should have written them down. But one of them was, why does Mordecai cast the lot to determine the time for the extermination of the Jewish people?
You mean Haman?
Yeah, I'm sorry. What did I say?
You said Mordecai.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
That's okay. That's all right. I heard... I'm not sure who from, most probably was Rabbi Chait, that a lot means that it's the fate of the Jew is haphazard, there's no real providence, and I could pick any month I want out of a hat to show. He wanted to show that there's really no divine relationship that God has with the Jew. And the truth is, that's why there was a party that the king made. They miscounted when the Jews would be saved from exile, and they saw the Jews still were not saved. So they said, that's it. You see, it's really false. This whole promise about the 70 years or whatever is false. The Jews really have no providence. And King Ahasuerus took out the priests, the high priest's garments, and wore them, and used vessels from the temple to drink in order to blaspheme the whole promise of the Torah and the whole elevated status of the high priest. You see, there was probably also a certain amount of jealousy because. The rabbis say that one tradesman is always jealous of somebody else in his trade. So it applies here. The king was jealous of the high priest, right? King Ahasuerus, he had a need to degrade the great figure of the Jews, which is the high priest. So he put on his clothing and said, see, there's nothing to it. I'm better. But the lottery was for, is interesting, it's a nice point. But Haman was also shared this, animosity towards the Jew. I mean, again, that was spurred on because Mordecai didn't bow to him. And he didn't even move, he didn't budge. And this was so intolerable to a guy like Haman. But you see the real, they say at the end of the Megillah, that at the end, the Jews, they reaccepted the Torah out of a love, which was to parallel the Torah acceptance at Sinai, which was out of a coercion. And the rabbis say that God held the mountain over the Jews at Sinai and said, accept the Torah here, and if not, this will be your burial spot. So it doesn't mean God held the mountain over them. I mean, that's just a medrash, it's a metaphor. But it does mean that there was a certain amount of coercion, meaning the event was so undeniably real that this is God orchestrating it, and God is the source of the Torah, that there is no, there was in a certain sense, difficult for the Jew to reject the acceptance of the Torah. So when you see something which is so clearly divine, so you can't go against it, you can't oppose it. But what happened by the Megillah? And you see, God's name is nowhere found in the Megillah. And a friend of mine suggested that that was to allow the personality and the cunning of Esther and Mordechai to be center stage in the whole story. But you see that you can't read the Megillah and not see God's hand at work. I mean, what happened? That the king was making this party, and they were celebrating the fact that the Jewish promise didn't come true, and he wanted his wife to come out and appear nude before, because they were talking, you know, the king was talking with the other princes or kings and saying, you know, my wife's more beautiful and this was it, no, mine is. So Ahasuerus said, yeah, I'll bring out my wife and you'll see, I'll prove it to you. Now, the thing which is interesting is that, you know, he wanted her to come out wearing just a crown. So the rabbis interpret that to mean the crown and nothing else, meaning to come out naked, to come out and show her real beauty. And it says about his wife, Vashti, that she had a habit of working women naked in her house, because she had the same character as Ahasuerus, that they were very lewd. They were, you know, very into the sexual. So why didn't she want to come out naked? This would be a great opportunity to express her sexual drive. So the Talmud says why she didn't come out. Anybody remember what we said? I think we had said this last year.
I thought she protested that she was the daughter of a queen.
Well, she was the queen.
Her daughter of a queen. But she was the princess of Nebuchadnezzar, wasn't she?
Oh, right, okay. But if she's so into... Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, and I thought the idea was that she thought it was demeaning for her to do that.
Well, if she worked women naked in her house, that means she liked it. So why wouldn't she want it as well? And I have to tell you what the Talmud says in order, because you could respond and say, well, she could work the women, she liked looking at it, but maybe she didn't want to do it herself. All right, you could say that, but if you read the Talmud, it says that the reason why she didn't come out naked was because Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, attached a tail to her. Did we ever discuss that?
No, I just got to pick them up in another class the other night.
All right, so we'll compare answers. We'll see which, I'd like to hear the answer you heard. But what does it mean that Gabriel attached a tail to her and therefore she was embarrassed to show her tail?
Rabbi?
Yes.
Can anyone answer?
Excuse me?
Are you asking for anyone to answer?
Yes, certainly you.
Okay. Okay, I put my foot in my mouth. I was just reading about that last night, actually. By the way, happy Purim to everybody. The reason that Vashti was ashamed also to show herself, in the nude, was because Gabriel had come and attached a tail to her. And the explanation of why a tail is because a tail, of all things that an animal has, is the thing that shows that something is an animal. Animals, people don't have tails, animals have tails. And that would show that she had an animalistic side to her, and therefore she has the tail, because she was like an animal in many ways. I could not understand why Ahasuerus wanted to parade his wife around unclad, because a man who is proud of his wife wouldn't want anything to anyone else to see her beauty, to see her at all, and to protect her at all costs. So it makes you wonder just what kind of a love affair they really had. It was maybe just for animal benefits, animalistic benefits. And the way it was explained was that the tail showed that she was an animal. She didn't care about the nudity as much as she cared about the people seeing her tail.
Well, that would be...
That's what I want to know, if that's actually true.
Well, that's true. I mean, tail is the one... Yeah, tail is the one thing which animals have and people don't. For example, animals and people both share eyes, ears, and so on. But the tail is something which is purely animal. Now, the question is, well, Vashti, we know, was animalistic. So what do we care that she didn't care about that? She worked with women in the nude. She had no problem showing that she was animalistic. So what more are we learning from the statement that Gabriel attached the tail to her? It seems to just be saying it was exaggerated. Her animal side was exaggerated.
Uh-huh.
So why didn't she want to come out? It seems to be it's going with the very emotion that she enjoyed. Doesn't seem like he's stunting the expression. It sounds like he's emphasizing her ability to enjoy this emotion. So why did she come?
That's a good question.
Yeah. So I think you have to understand a little bit in terms of how the psyche works, and that is that when it says that she didn't want to come out, that meant to say that there was embarrassment. That means that the ego, at this one time, was more powerful than her drive for the sexual. So typically, and you see that, what does it mean that Gabriel attached it? It means that it was a divine act. Gabriel means that God did something. He used an angel. He used some force, whatever the force was. There was no real tail attached to her, of course. But it means that something had to come into play here, because she would have agreed to her husband and danced. But now what happened was God forced her hand by creating some stronger feeling of ego, meaning to say there was an embarrassment of it being too open, that she was a... animalistic. So a tail means that it was something which was clearly her ego now had the upper hand. And because of the ego, she protested coming out, because that was the emotion that she gave into more at this point than the sexual. So although the tail is the animal side, which she was always used to, then it means to say that it became something which was bothersome to her. It was now ugly. A tail is something on a person that is, you know, a person likes to cloak, and they're sexual. And that's why there's a concept of, like, foreplay. Well, there's a certain amount that a person wines and dines somebody before they take them home and then they have intercourse. Because there is the whole concept means that there has to be certain dignity involved in the whole process. The person just can't knock on the door, take off the clothes, and in the secular world, they won't do that. Because it's too embarrassing. So that's the same thing over here. If you could imagine, you know, what shame a guy would have if he didn't wine and dine his date for a few hours and then take her back and so on, then they would both have, you know, consensual sex. But if he would just knock on the door and then start taking off his clothing, she would be disgusted by it. And the truth is, a person typically won't do that because it goes against the ego. But Vashti was not like that. She would have done that, right? But here, so therefore, something had to come in, a divine act had to come in to protect that. Okay. So, you see just a few words in the Talmud, it opens up the area. And what happens? So now there's a suggestion after she protested, and Haman suggested to the king that, you know, he didn't want to just, take a, you know, he was very upset with his wife. To the point that he even consented to killing her. But it had to be something which was a political issue. It couldn't just be so small. The king can't do something which is so small. A king everything has to be in very big scope because he's important. Rabbi Chaya explained that once too, that why did Paro like Joseph's interpretations of the seven cows? Because the astrologers also gave interpretations to Paro. And it says you're going to have seven daughters, and you'll bury seven daughters. So what was any more appealing about Joseph's interpretation? So Rabbi Chaya explained, because Joseph was explaining how this was a matter of national concern. So that satisfied a king who feels that everything in his life has to be of great magnitude. So that's why it appealed to him more than just simply his daughters who can live and die. That's not something that should be the greatest concern to a king. Okay, so here, Haman suggested make a big movement that this is now, it's not just Vashti is going against you, but now this is now a movement. This is something which you have to make an edict, and you'll be able to kill her this way, under the guise that the man has to be the ruler in his house. So Ahasuerus, the king, bought that, and he agreed, and they sent out letters everywhere saying the man should be the king of his house, and he should rule the house. So the rabbis say, were it not for this first letter, the Jews would have been destroyed. Why? Because this first letter, when people received it and all of his promises, so they said, what type of foolish king do we have? Of course, the man's the ruler of his house. Like the people saying, this king is foolish. This is nothing new. So therefore, when the next letter came out where, Haman was, he also had the same type of a problem. When he saw that Mordechai wouldn't bow to him, he also, it was despicable to Haman that he should just pick on one guy, because then it would show that he's bothered by one little person. Haman's bigger than that. He's at second in command. So that's why he made a big political movement too, that there's people and they don't listen to your laws, and the king shouldn't keep them, he should wipe them out. So the king gave his ring over to Haman, and he said, go ahead. And Haman even gave him thousands of silver pieces. He said, I'll pay for the war. The king says, no, don't worry about it. I'll pay for it. Which shows you that the king was equally anti-Semitic. But he was also opportunist, so he would shift depending on, the time. So when they sent out the next letter to kill the Jews, so the people again got the letter and they said, oh, here's a stupid king again with another letter. So they didn't take it on so seriously at first. So it was because of that first letter that they already disqualified Ahasuerus, that the second letter didn't get the people riled up against the Jews so quickly, and it gave the Jews the edge. But as you read the story, you see that there's these events that take place. Even though God's name is not in there, in the whole Megillah, but you see, for example, that when they had a new contest, who's going to be the next queen, so who gets in, of course? Esther, one of the most brilliant people of the society, and somebody who was able to maneuver, and we'll see in a moment what the maneuver was. So she gets into the position of queen. And then it just so happens another accidental, quote-unquote, accidental event, where Mordechai happens to hear the two conspirators planning the assassination of the king. And he communicates it to Esther, and she tells it to the king in Mordechai's name. They investigate it, they find out it's true, and they kill those two guys. And they wrote it down in the book. But nothing was rewarded to Mordechai at that point for being loyal to the king. But nonetheless, he was able to be at the right moment, at the right time. And then you see the story goes on, and using the intelligence, Mordechai doesn't bow to the king. And this sets off Haman, and this sets off the whole chain of events that now he wants to destroy Mordechai. So the king agrees. So the letters go out, and Mordechai finds out about this, and he cries a bitter cry in the town square, and he communicates it to Esther, and he says, you have to do something in terms of saving the Jews. So she says, I can't. If I go before the king and I'm not called, so there's a death penalty for that. So Mordechai says to Esther, if you don't do it, the salvation will come from some other source, and don't think that you and your family will escape. So she says, okay, I'll do it. And she says, let you gather all the Jews and fast for 3 days, night and day, and I'll go before the king. And she comes up with a plan. Somebody wanted to say something? Okay, I thought I heard something. Okay, so she comes up with a plan. So what's the plan? So she doesn't go to the king straight and say, listen, and the king loved her. He said, I'll give anything up, half of the kingdom is how much he was devoted to Esther. He was really very taken by her, which is also an interesting phenomenon. Another thing, why was she this attachment to Esther so much? So what does Esther do? She invites the king and Haman to a wine party. So the king, of course, is very excited. He tells Haman, get ready. The queen has invited us, so they get there. And he says to her, ask what you like, and I'll give you up to half the kingdom. So she says, respectfully, it pleases the king, I ask that you and Haman come to another wine party I'm going to make tomorrow night. So why is she doing that? Why is she making two parties? So Rabbi Chaid explained that what he was doing, what Esther was doing, was she understood psychology very well. And she was planting seeds of suspicion in the king's mind. And that's why it says right after this, that night the king could not sleep. Why couldn't the king sleep? Because he was suspicious. What's going on, Esther and Haman? Why is she only inviting him, two of them? What's going on? So he's thinking, and how can he find out? So he tells his officers, bring me the record, the book of record of the kingdom. And he just happens, again, another event, just happens to be that he gets to the page where Mordechai saved his life earlier. And keep in mind that the Megillah story was spanned 11 years. Right, so we read it very quickly, but it took an 11-year period. So it could be years earlier. So the king asked, oh, really, Mordechai, that's right, I remember that. And what great honor was done for this loyal subject? So his officers said nothing was done to Mordechai at all. And at that moment, again, another perfectly timed event. So what happened, just to give you a little background, so Haman kept on seeing Mordechai not budging and not bowing to him, even though it was an edict. And the king allowed this. So he was bothered so much. So when he went back home, he spoke to his family, his loved ones, and his wife, his Zeresh. And he says, I'm invited to the king's feast, just me and the king and Esther. So he was so proud of himself. But he says to his family, he says, but all that is worthless because I'm so bothered by the fact that Mordechai doesn't move when he sees me. So his wife said, and as his family said, why don't you make Gallo, 50 feet tall, and you'll hang there, and you'll ask the king, and we'll hang Mordechai. So he loved the idea. Haman loved that idea. But they told him, go to the king in the morning and ask this. But Haman was so impetuous that he couldn't, and he went in the middle of the night. And this is when the king couldn't sleep. It just happens to be the same time. He couldn't sleep that night. And he's up, and he's reading the records. He just finished finding out that Mordechai, nothing was rewarded to him. And then he asked, who's in the courtyard? Because they see some in the courtyard. It's Haman. And I'm not sure whether it says or not that... See, it says in the narrative that... let me just get it. One second. It sounds like it's a narrative that it says that he was in the courtyard. And... Yeah, so he asked the question. This is in Esther 6:4. So right after I found out that nothing was done, in 6:3 it says nothing was done to Mordechai. Then the very next verse says, and the king said, who's in the courtyard? Evidently he saw somebody in the distance from his palace window. Then it sounds like a narrative. It says, and Haman came to the courtyard to the house of the king, the outer courtyard, to say to the king to hang Mordechai on a tree. Now that sounds like a narrative. So the question is, was this told to the king or not? It seems to be it was. But in 6:5 is when the answer came. He asked who's there, and then there's a narrative. And then it says that the young man of the king said, Haman stands in the courtyard. So the king said, come in. So it would seem to be, though, that he knew. Because the next thing is that the king says to Haman, very, very, connivingly, he says, what should a king do for one of his loyal subjects that he wants to repay back? So Haman thought, well, who does the king love more than me? So Haman expressed, yeah, you should give him the king's horse and the crown and the king's clothing and ride around the square and announce that this is what the king does to those who are loyal. Because he was imagining it was going to happen to him. So the king was also testing Haman at this point, too. And he sees now that Haman is, because he was suspicious of Haman. That's why, why did Esther invite just me and Haman to this party? So now he had an opportunity. He felt him out, and he sees, oh, he's after the kingdom. And he can't even cover it up. I mean, you see how impetuous and foolish Haman could be when he has the opportunity. That he was completely uncontrolled with his emotions. So the king says, do exactly what you said to Mordechai. So you see how the timing, just when the king feels he's got to repay Mordechai, here's this guy coming and he wants to kill Mordechai? So now the tables are starting to turn a bit. And then he does this, and Haman was like, you know, completely disgusted that he was honoring the one that really he felt should honor him. And then they go, he ended up to the next feast. And now Ahasuerus was primed, and this is exactly what Esther's plan was. So they go to the second wine feast, and the king says again to Esther, ask what you want, and I'll give you up to half the kingdom. So he finally, you know, hears from Esther. Esther says that if it was just me, I wouldn't have said anything, but it's my whole people that is an evil person that wants to wipe us all out. And he says, who is this? He got angry. So she said it was Haman. And Ahasuerus was so angry, he stormed out of the feast, went out to the porch, and the rabbis say that he saw Haman, or the angels of Haman, that were plucking up all the trees from his kingdom. So it wasn't even plucking up the trees. It means that when you look out at your kingdom and you see the beauty, and it was now being destroyed, it was taken over by Haman, meaning he was now, he saw it clear. So again, there were no angels visually. It meant that now something started pushing him towards that. And he came back in, and it said there was another divine act which took place, that the angels came and pushed Haman onto the bed where Esther was. But he was really pleading for his life because Esther just accused him. So evidently something happened that when he the visual that the king saw when he came back in, that Haman was a little bit too close for comfort. He was too close to Esther. And he says, you're going to take my wife while I'm still in the house? So Harvona, who was on Haman's side before this, now sees that it's no good for Haman anymore, and he switches. He was an opportunist also. So he quickly says, you know, Haman had this gallows built in his courtyard, hint, hint, you know, suggesting that he hangs Haman. So Ahasuerus says, yes, take Haman out and then hang him. So you see how, even without God being overtly mentioned in the Megillah, how the events worked and how the wisdom, the person's living the proper life, so God steps in and will, you see all the timing of the events is what I'm trying to bring out. I mean, it's just something which when the people saw, that's why they reaccepted Torah out of a love. They saw that when people live the right life, they could use their intelligence, and God comes into a system and works with them. And that was something which just created tremendous attachment to the Torah. And that's why it says that they reaccepted the Torah now out of a love, because they saw how the right life is complemented by God intervening and working things out for you. So although God's name is not, you know, overtly mentioned, they saw clearly that it was. And Ibn Ezra actually says clearly that you see that the Megillah was written with a divine inspiration. All right. But, you know, the timing of all the events, and Esther becoming the queen as opposed to the hundreds or thousands of others who were there. I mean, you see all the different things that God stepped in to do to make sure that these intelligent people had what was necessary. If Esther had not become the queen, or if Mordechai had not heard about these two guys, the conspirators that wanted to assassinate King Ahasuerus, and if King Ahasuerus had not just turned to that page at night, and the timing of the events, it just happened to be when he read about that, that's when Haman came in the middle of the night, even though his family told him, we'll go in the morning. No, he was too impetuous. He came that night. So at the moment that the king was feeling most appreciation to Mordechai, that's when Haman comes in and he wants to kill that person. So the timing was very good. And Esther also, creating that suspicion, because if she would have gone to King Ahasuerus directly and said, Haman wants to wipe out my people, he would have dismissed it. He wouldn't have been so readily accepting to hang Haman. But once she put him in a state and he couldn't sleep at night, he was suspicious, and the suspicion started to build. Now he was primed to hear something that really pushed him over the edge. But you see, even after all that, it was still necessary that some divine act caused Haman to be fallen on the bed, meaning he had to see something concrete. Even though Esther planted the suspicion and then made this accusation, and the king went out and he didn't say anything right away, and he looked and he started imagining all the trees in his courtyard being uprooted by Haman, still it was still necessary that, see, I think the way that worked is that the king was into just, you know, lavish feasts, and he was a real, you know, a hedonist. And he left all the politics in Haman. He gave him his ring. He didn't want to be bothered by certain things. So keeping Haman was a convenience for him. Maybe that was why there was a reluctance to give in. But once he walked back in and he saw Haman falling on the bed, that was it. Now that impinged perhaps on the very hedonism, the sexual that he had for Esther, and that sealed the fate of Haman. Maybe up to that point he wouldn't have agreed. And that would make sense. That's why it was necessary that some sort of an act, a divine act, pushed him onto the bed. Because he still would have been, you know, despite everything Esther said, it was still a convenience for Ahasuerus to keep somebody around like Haman. He took care of all his, you know, political maneuvers. He could just have fun all day. So you see more about the personalities that way. But you see the timing. I mean, it's clear, right? Everybody see it? No, this is just unnatural. It had to be God behind the scenes doing all this. Okay. All right, so I have to wrap it up early. We're having afternoon services shortly, so I'm going to head over there. So if there's any questions, let me see if you have any questions or comments.
Rabbi, when I listened to Rabbi Weiss the other night talking about the issue with the tail, he made the comment that Vashti realized that they viewed her as just as an animal, and that was distasteful to her to be relegated to that role. Is that what you were saying?
No, I was saying more. I was saying that you have to explain why the Talmud says that Gabriel attached the tail to her. I mean, there was something divine which took place. Otherwise, she would have come out naked. According to Rabbi Weiss, if they ask him, well, she felt that way, so what's the explanation of Gabriel in the Talmud? So I'm suggesting an explanation is that she would have come out, you know, just with the crown on, wearing nothing, because she enjoyed that type of, you know, she enjoyed the exposing herself. But she didn't, because at this one moment, something divine happened, which empowered her ego, and she viewed the ego as more important now, and she had a disgust, like as if she had a tail. So normally she wouldn't have repelled the chance at the parading naked in front of other people. But it was a divine thing at this point because it was in order to orchestrate an opening for Esther to step in. But according to what he's saying, I don't see the divine element according to what Weiss is saying. So maybe ask him to, you know, elaborate on that.
All right, I have one other question, but if you have to go, then we can do it another time.
No, I still have a few more minutes. Go ahead.
At the beginning of chapter 10, I mean, we've held that there's nothing in the Torah, at least, and I assume the Tanakh, that does not have a purpose for us.
Right.
And the very first sentence says that King Ahasuerus levied.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mary. The phone went dead. Doug, you still there?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. So the first verse, and it says that he levied a tax. What was your question now?
What's the purpose of that piece of information?
Yeah,
I was. Seems like it doesn't fit into the story and has no value.
I know. I think about that too. It struck me last night. I don't have an answer. It's a good question. Let me give you some thought.
Okay.
It bothered me too. It just like where it seems to be so disconnected. Yep. Okay. All right, so I guess we'll wrap it up here. We'll pick up next week. Hopefully, Jim, I'll get back to your question. And we'll see today. Maybe I'll discuss your question, Doug, with a couple of friends and see if they have any ideas on that.
Okay.
You ready?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you, Brad.
Have a great
day, everybody.
Thank you very much. And everybody have a good Purim. Have a good day. And then we'll catch up next Sunday, same time.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Happy Purim to all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.